The Sunstone Foundation presents Orbits of Closeness, 25 Years of Women Relating to the Church. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
Saying Levina. Does this work? Is this working? Is anyone saying Levina Anders? I'm sure she's on her way. She is supposed to be here, but perhaps our time is getting away from us. And
is it on?
Is it because it's too high?
Get right to your mouth, Dave.
Okay. We okay? Is it okay now? Sorry. Anyway, my name is Mary Kay Peterson. I am with Dialogue, and we are very proud to be sponsoring this session of the Sunstone Symposium, entitled Orbits of Closeness, 25 Years of Closeness to the Church. Of women. I have it somewhere. I wasn't planning to do this. 25 Years of Women Relating to the Church. I'm sorry. I'll have it right here. Can you hear now? And here we are saved. We're very
I
happy.
My car is towed away.
Can we get someone to move it?
Oh, no. It's legally parked, just very precariously.
Test the mic again. Let's see if that's
okay.
Right.
They're having trouble hearing. So
with in the back?
Yes. You've got it, lady.
Now, are both of these mics supposed to be operational?
I think that's taping, and this is what we have to be concerned about.
Welcome to the Dialogue-sponsored session on Orbits of Closeness. This morning we plan a very personal kind of sharing as we reflect on our individual relationships to the Church over the past two decades or more. It seems that there have been a lot of current affairs about Mormon women lately, and this panel is an attempt to take a long-range view, to survey the dimensions of the forest, to chart the global currents of our relationships rather than the last wave on the beach. One of our purposes is to chart personal changes in us that may have caused changes in our relationship with the Church, changes in the Church that may have precipitated changes in us, but certainly changes in our perception. My personal feeling is that looking at such changes is a consoling process. It induces philosophy, acceptance, laughter, and wisdom. Even grief, if you live with it for two or three decades, becomes a familiar companion, not a terrifying apparition. And perhaps most consoling of all, the sheer fact of survival in the Church for two decades or more as feminists is in itself, all other considerations aside, a sort of triumph. It is that triumph we want to share and celebrate today. Each panelist will take 10 or 15 minutes, leaving a good half hour for questions, responses, and shared stories from you. We invite such responses and have tailored our presentations to make sharing easy, I hope. The panelists, because they will be speaking autobiographically, require minimal introduction. Each one of them is, in my book, a terrific role model of important experiences, many of them painful, fully lived. Unsparing intelligence applied to these experiences, and the humor, hope, and grace to keep on going. I'll make some introductory remarks about myself first, and then our next panelist will be Lori Winter Stromberg. She is a proprietor of Los Angeles Art in Los Angeles, where she currently lives with her husband, son, and daughter. She is on the national board of Sunstone and was the founder of Sunstone West, which she has also chaired since then, but no more?
I'm now in business.
Yes, okay. She now is now in business. And she was also on the she also worked with Exponent 2 and has been a lively contributor to the Dialogue of Mormon Women ever since. Our next panelist will be Charlotte England. Charlotte has raised a fine family of six children, and who are now providing her with beautiful and delightful grandchildren. Charlotte is a fine violinist. She has also been a businesswoman. I still remember her legendary ice cream in her ice cream parlor at in Provo. She has traveled widely and has lived abroad in England with her husband and a very extended family of 50 or 60 BYU students, which would test the parenthood capacity of most, and is now seriously working on art. And I got to see some of what she was doing this summer, and it's quite impressive. Our fourth panelist is Marie Jones. Marie has lived probably widely abroad than any other 10 people in this room put together, and I hope she will tell you about some of those experiences. She has unique experience raising three sons in third world countries, in many places where they were the only members of the church. And so they have not only lived in the mission field, they have been the mission field. And yet this has been an experience that has not been without its trauma, as the institutional church has impacted both on them and on people they have been close to. And we will be speaking in an intimate way, and I hope that we will provide an opportunity for you and the encouragement for you to respond to us in the same way. I had the immense good fortune to be persecuted for my religion when I was growing up. My parents moved from a solidly Mormon community in Idaho, where my father was the bishop, when I was about 12, to the Columbia Basin in Washington, where the construction of the Grand Coulee Dam had made it possible to bring thousands of acres under cultivation. One side effect was to upset the existing agricultural base of dryland farming, much of it by families of German extraction who had been in the area for more than a generation. Since many of the new farmers came from Mormon areas of Utah and Idaho, the economic differences coincided with religious differences. The only church in town to that point had been a comfortable little congregational community. Now, of course, there was a Mormon church, followed closely by a Catholic church that mainly served the Mexican farm workers. The congregational minister responded by preaching openly anti-Mormon sermons that were, for a time, quite popular with his parishioners. The natural problems of integrating newcomers with old and well-established families were thus exacerbated by religious suspicions. I'll have to admit that the persecution amounted to mild social ostracism and very mild name-calling. Mormons were called carrot snappers for reasons I have never been able to determine. Our school was too little to turn up its nose at husky Mormon athletes who soon reinforced the teams enough to make them respectable. But the line between the beer drinkers and the Kool-Aid drinkers, the girls who did and those who didn't in the back seats, and those who indulged in the unshocking, by today's standards, profanity, was a sharp one. I don't want to imply that all non-Mormon girls did, either. but there were few enough Mormon girls that we were all in one category. To my memory, Mormons and non-Mormons did not date or party together. The reason I call this good fortune is that with very little inconvenience or distress to me, I chose Mormonism and its values as my own, solidifying my already solid Mormon identity and bonding culturally with my own community. The most important predictive fact about me at that time was that I was a Mormon. It explained me, it summarized me, and it justified me. It is only with considerable hindsight that I realize it also limited me. I was something of a jerk in high school. It is a fact that I was astronomically better read than my contemporaries, but I never learned, and in fact saw no reason for learning, how to make that store of knowledge palatable to my peers, or how to use my considerable intelligence to help in building a community. I was, on the contrary, rather proud of the weary anti-intellectualism that my presence prompted. After all, if the glory of God was intelligence, then I was being persecuted for being smart. Socially, I was also pretty retarded. I had one date in high school, and that was with a neighbor boy whose mother was sending him along as a chaperone for his older sister and her date. It was a highly uncomfortable experience, which we did not repeat. But I was able to call my prudery and uncertainty chastity, and again considered myself persecuted for my religion. In short, as I grew into consciousness of myself as an individual, it was as a Mormon individual. My orbit was a tight one, closely controlled by what I perceived to be the major values and norms of the church. My mission in France, graduating twice from BYU and spending 8 years on the staff of the Ensign, were all experiences that both deepened and challenged my simple one-to-one identification with the church. What does that orbit look like now? I hold a temple recommend and go regularly, though not frequently, to the temple. I teach primary, as I have since age 14, with a few gaps. I have been a visiting teacher since my freshman year in college. I subscribe to and read all of the scenes. We hold family prayer, attend church regularly, and read the scriptures together. My spiritual life, I feel, is deeper and richer than it has ever been before. But in many important ways, I feel like a marginalized Mormon. Mormon is not the only word that describes me now. Other important elements of my identity are intellectual and feminist. The church through BYU gave me what I consider to be a first-rate education and reinforced an everlasting hunger for learning, but I am more often bored in sacrament meeting, state conference, and general conference than not. I find that the main lessons my son is learning in primary are to sit still, to guess what answer the teacher wants, and not to volunteer information or ask questions. As a feminist, I feel deeply alienated from the structure of the church. I feel that the church systematically exploits the labor of its women, praises them, but patronizes them and excludes them from decision-making council and from control of the funds, and this in spite of a wonderfully inclusive theology. When a church without a professional clergy relies on the service of its members to function, it is a source of deep pain to me that women are automatically excluded from many opportunities to serve simply because of their gender. Spiritually, most of what I feel as my closeness to God comes from independent study of the scriptures and also from intensive reading and other religious traditions. As a result, my feelings of attachment to both the church and the gospel are deep and powerful, but I am no longer willing to let the church decide my values for me, have first claim on my time, or speak for me. It is not always a comfortable position. It is exhausting to analyze every conference talk and keep thinking, "But he means so well." It is painful to feel wounded by the sexism in the temple ceremony instead of simply being comforted by its familiar rhythms. It is difficult to provide consistent service on one level, while on another I resent decisions that are being made that affect me and over which I have no control. But I feel fiercely, profoundly, and genetically attached to the church. That initial choice of being Mormon cannot be undone, nor do I wish to unmake it. I am not the teenager who willingly made herself a tabula rasa for the church to write on, but I have, appropriately enough, become an editor, adding, deleting, recasting, and cramming the margins with questions. I am no astronomer, to return to the image of our panel subject, but part of the harmony of the universe I feel comes from my resistance to, as well as my attraction to, the church. If the attraction becomes too strong, then we do not have a planet in orbit around the sun, but a body falling into the sun to be destroyed. I hope that my personal orbit, parallel to but not identical with that of the church, means that in the economy of the universe, both bodies may move. We'll hear Lori now.
Can you hear in the back? My mother said during my last response no one could hear me. So, can you hear? Okay. My husband suggested that I use some of the techniques we learned in Lamaze class to help ease my nervousness. You know Dr. Lamaze, the Marquis de Lamaze? He's the man who asserted that a woman could overcome the excruciating pain of childbirth through rhythmic breathing. Well, that's not unrelated to what I want to talk about today. I want to focus on two prevailing, often competing values in Mormonism. One emphasizes deference to authority and obedience, and the other the exercise of individual agency and the validity of personal experience, or revelation, if you will. I think my life reflects a shift in emphasis from the former to the latter. I was raised in an active LDS home in Los Angeles, although my familial roots were solidly in Pioneer, Utah. Unlike Levina, I wasn't persecuted for my religious faith. Most of my friends were not Mormons, and while my Mormonism was recognized and often discussed, it was never a divisive issue. In high school, during the late 60s, I became a member of the prevailing counterculture and was accepted therein, fortunately without leaping into the morass of drugs that claimed many of my friends. I drove, they indulged.
Predominantly non-Mormon friends and increasing political liberalism notwithstanding, my personal identification and spiritual life was solidly Mormon. I was a questioner, but my questions were always deferential to ecclesiastical authority and solidly within a context of belief. The church is true. How is it true? Naturally, I went to BYU. It was God's university. It was where I thought I would find the eternal mate, the priesthood holder I had been groomed to desire, who would lead me into the celestial kingdom. BYU was a culture shock for me. In L.A., miniskirts, boots for other than snow attire, and long, straight hair weren't really symbols of anything except prevailing fashion. There, I was the straight but likable Mormon. At BYU, I was immediately perceived as loose and liberal. I began to doubt myself. I used to get invited to beer parties at BYU, and I was just aghast. I thought, beer parties? This is BYU. Oh, well. I didn't go either. But I began to doubt myself, to distrust my experience. Maybe I wasn't the Mormon I thought I was. After all, this was God's university, God's culture. Why didn't I fit in? After my first semester, I came home with a dress to the floor, electric rollers, an obsessive desire to be what God, in the form perhaps of President Wilkinson, wanted me to be. Most of all, I wanted God to talk to me just like he talked to everybody else at BYU. Throughout my experience there, I tithed, fasted, attended church regularly, prayed, and read the scriptures daily. I was, I think, one of the few that raised their hand in my first world literature classes that had read the Bible from cover to cover. I even dated returned missionaries. And then something happened. Maybe it was my latent political liberalism, maybe the natural consequences of my inquisitive nature, maybe because I was as smart as or smarter than most of the guys I went out with, one of whom was supposed to lead me throughout eternity. And maybe it was Tom Rogers as a bishop at the time who introduced me to Dostoevsky and the Grand Inquisitor. Whatever the reason, I was ready to listen when a family home evening sister destined for law school invited me to a meeting of the Utah Valley chapter of the Women's Political Caucus. Yes, there was one there. I went and was converted to the ERA. At that time, the church hadn't taken a stand on the controversial amendment. Indeed, it was openly debated on campus, with now Utah Supreme Court Justice Christine Durham taking the pro side. Anyone remember that? I sported my ERA now button, ERA now button, only to learn that most people on campus thought I was an overly eager church magazine representative. I also began to realize why I found irritating compliments from men like, "I just thought you were a normal girl, but you've got a head on your shoulders." While I embraced the concept of equal opportunity for men and women in society and began questioning established social norms, it took me a while to seriously question the patriarchal underpinnings of the church. The Vietnam War and Watergate contributed to the erosion of my faith in secular authority. Though never a disciple of Sonia Johnson, her excommunication and the underhanded way church leaders orchestrated opposition to the ERA were painfully disillusioning to me. My faith in their authority also began to erode. I had to learn to trust my own experience, to take responsibility for it. In her book, Sexism and God Talk, Rosemary Radford Ruther asserts that the religious experience must be grounded in the human experience. And I'm going to quote extensively from her here. Codified tradition both reaches back to roots in experience and is constantly renewed or discarded through the test of experience. Experience includes experience of the divine, experience of oneself, and experience of the community and the world in an interacting dialectic. Received symbols, formulas, and laws are either authenticated or not through their ability to illuminate and interpret experience. Systems of authority try to reverse this relation and make received symbols dictate what can be experienced as well as the interpretation of what is experienced. I want to read that again. Systems of authority try to reverse this relation and make received symbols dictate what can be experienced as well as the interpretation of that which is experienced. In reality, the relation is the opposite, or should be the opposite. If a symbol does not speak authentically to experience, it becomes dead or must be altered to provide a new meaning. The uniqueness of feminist theology lies not in its use of the criterion of experience, but rather in its use of women's experience, which has been almost entirely shut out of theological reflection in the past. The use of women's experience in feminist theology, therefore, explodes as a critical force. Someone have a Kleenex? I'm going to be sniffing throughout the rest of this. Sorry. The use of women's experience in feminist theology, therefore, explodes as a critical force. Exposing classical theology, including its codified traditions, as based on male experience rather than on universal human experience. Mind you, she's not excluding male experience either. What she's doing is being inclusive. Feminist theology makes the sociology of theological knowledge visible, no longer hidden behind mystifications of objectified divine and universal authority. Unquote. Male monotheism and patriarchal authority over women has been so taken for granted in the Judeo-Christian tradition that even when Joseph Smith introduced the radical notion of human divinization, of men and women becoming gods and goddesses, he appropriated traditional patriarchal patterns and fashioned his concept of exaltation according to them. The traditional hierarchy of God, male, female, in which women are connected to God secondarily through the male, was preserved. Rosemary Radford Ruther describes this traditional pattern. God is modeled after the patriarchal ruling class and is seen as addressing this class of males directly, adopting them as his sons. They are his representatives, the responsible partners of the covenant with him. Wives, along with children and servants, represent those ruled over and owned by the patriarchal class. They related to man as he related to God. In Mormon terms, Wilford Woodruff taught that the man is the head of, and the god of the woman. I'm quoting from him. But let him act like a god in virtuous principles and godlike conversation, walk, and deportment. If not found worthy, they shall be hurled down to perdition, and their family and kingdom be given to another. According to Kirtland resident Benjamin F. Johnson, Joseph Smith taught him that the first command was to multiply, and that dominion and power in the great future would be commensurate with the number of wives and children that we inherit here, and that our great mission on earth was to organize a nucleus of heaven to take with us, to the increase of which there would be no end. Culturally bound and literally minded, early male church leaders asked how a man could become a king without a kingdom. He could not. They decided, and thus women, through polygynous relationships and children, became facilitators of a man's kingdom building, indeed jewels in his eternal crown. My very being rejects this male-centered patriarchal model. Feeling as I do, you might wonder how I relate to the church. The LDS tradition is my tradition. I find some of its doctrines spiritually and intellectually compelling. I'm not enumerating any of those now, but later on we can discuss some of them perhaps. But overall, I am skeptical when dealing with its assumptions, ordering values, and definitions. I very much value community. Fortunately, much of my life has been spent in areas of the country where there were enough ward members who shared my concerns to make me feel part of a supportive religious community. Unfortunately, that is not the case now. My views, particularly on the position of women in LDS doctrine and culture, are not looked upon favorably by the overwhelming majority of my ward members. Indeed, my Relief Society president, anticipating a recent lesson on priesthood, asked me to reserve comment. I refused, of course. But my optimism about grassroots female support for change in the church's position on women was diminished. Where there is no precedent, writes historian Gerda Lerner in The Creation of Patriarchy, one cannot imagine alternatives to existing conditions. It is this feature of male hegemony which has been most damaging to women and has ensured their subordinate status for millennia. Men's version of history, legitimized as the universal truth, has been presented to women as women as marginal to civilization. And as long as both men and women regard the subordination of half the human race to the other as natural, it is impossible to envision a society in which differences do not connote either dominance or subordination. Concluding her book, Lerner asserts, the system of patriarchy is a historic construct. It has a beginning. It will have an end. Since such a shift in Mormonism constitutes a major rewriting of LDS exaltation theology, I am not holding my breath. I am, however, learning to trust my own experience and reordering my life accordingly. Thank you.
Speaking of labor pains, all these years I've been on the other side of this podium listening to my husband get papers or someone else get papers. And so the ones that I gave labor pains for are most of them here. And I really appreciate the support they have given me in doing this for you.
Think of these as your friends.
Well, they pick me up if I faint. My relationship to the church in the past, I picked the past 40 years, has changed considerably. I will describe some of these experiences that have led up to this change. I grew up in a patriarchal home, a very patriarchal home, a father that carried out what he saw as priesthood responsibilities, directing with no consideration of our feelings or opinion. I don't think it occurred to him that there might be more to it than that kind of dominance. I learned to obey anyone in authority. It hadn't occurred to me to do otherwise. I thought it my duty to obey and not to question parents, teachers, or any leader. I thought their ideas and opinions were certainly more valid than my own, and I had but to follow. My first experience to take on leadership myself came as a Sunday school teacher when I was in high school to 5- and 6-year-olds, and I put everything into these lessons. If there had been such a title as Queen of Visual Arts, I would have earned it. It was not enough to draw a picture of the pioneers in covered wagons. We had to make the covered wagon with the oxen on it. It was a great way to use my art abilities that I inherited from my mother and my grandmother. So I loved doing that. I took the calling of a teacher seriously and felt very responsible for the children. It was productive, and with it came a sense of freedom for me. I felt in control of something. A few years later, when I was not quite 20 and not quite 2 years of college, I was married. 6 months after that, Jean and I were serving a mission in Samoa. Our first assignment was teaching in a village in the top of the island of Savai'i. We shared a termite-eaten house with 4 other elders. There was little privacy, no electricity, a rain barrel was our source of water, and the typical crawling creatures of the tropics were ever present. We grew to love the people fully with our hearts. An experience there led me to lean on my own strength and faith for the first time in my life. Jean had contacted some sort of fungus on his fingers that developed and got worse, and suddenly one morning, it was so bad that his hand was swollen, extremely swollen, and blood poisoning had set in. I knew what those red streaks meant up his arm. After all, I had read The Yearling and seen the movie with Gregory Peck after he was bitten by the rattlesnake. So here I am, a 20-year-old bride of a few months and a missionary trying to do the right thing. I felt very, very much alone. Fasting and prayer took on a new meaning with me as I pled with the Lord for 3 days. There was no thought to call the mission president from the other island. no phone anyway to call him, and a letter by slow boat wouldn't have helped. My ingenuity, faith, and strength were put to the test. There was no one in authority to tell me what to do. I was on my own, and I drew upon every ability I had to help Gene get well. He did get well. A few years later, at Stanford University, where Gene and I served in different wards most of the time, as he served in the bishopric of a student ward, and I took our six children to a ward that had a primary, I think I broke the Sabbath every Sunday, as there was as much activity juggling my church callings and getting six children ready under 9 years for Sunday as there was anything I would do the rest of the week. But I served faithfully and without question. Sometimes we would wave to each other in the car as we would pass each other as he would be going to his meeting, I'd be coming home from mine. Minnesota was our next move, and an awakening to me as I experienced a different view of a church calling. We had barely moved into the small community of Northfield, Minnesota, where Gene was to serve as Dean of Academic Affairs at St. Olaf College, when I received a phone call from the mission home, which was just 30 miles north in Minneapolis. The mission president's wife asked me to dress the body of a woman for burial in her temple clothes. She had been a patient in the Odd Fellows home for the last several years of her life, and she was a member of the church. I hesitated when I heard this phone request, and the thought ran through my mind, isn't this what Relief Society presidents are supposed to do? Someone with more authority? She suggested that I get someone to assist me, and of the only two member families in town, I called, and the first one refused. She just said I couldn't handle it, and I finally talked the other one into going with me. I was terrified as I approached the mortuary after earnest prayer to get me through this. But as the two of us entered the room and saw the small, thin frame in her crippled position, her legs had crippled or something to her joints, that her legs were folded up, and there was no way we could straighten them out as we dressed her. And so had been in that position her past few years of her life. But as I saw her body on the table there, and we were alone in the room, a peace came over me, and my fear of death and the corpse left for that moment. I felt blessed. I know it was a time that I really was assisted by God to do this, because the fear of death itself and everything had returned after that. A few weeks later, I became that person who I thought was supposed to take care of such matters. I was called to be the District Relief Society president to the branches scattered from one end of the state to the other. The most remarkable thing was not the workload and traveling, but how the women looked to me as an authoritarian figure. I was suddenly supposed to have answers for women struggling with many of the same things that I was. I gained a new perspective for one in position of authority, the responsibility of it all, the effect one can have on people simply by holding a particular position. I was afraid that any suggestion, advice, or opinion could be taken as gospel truth. This new perception of authority helped me develop empathy for people carrying that burden of being looked up to, as if they had resolved and neatly packaged the questions and answers to life. I realized how an individual's ego can be puffed up with that kind of recognition and attention if one doesn't keep a balance or perspective of their position. My patience is tried by those unwilling to keep a perspective to avoid using unrighteous dominion, whether it is a primary teacher, parents directing their family, a bishop, or a stake leader. This whole experience caused me to look at myself when I felt justified to take hurt from an authoritarian figure by something they said or did that didn't meet with my expectations. I realized the responsibility lay with both parties. Brother Benyon was a living example to me, as I remember sitting in his classes and his home, encouraging us to think, to behave in a manner that was true to ourselves, as he challenged us in service to those who needed what we could give. Rather than taking hurt for injustices done, he taught patience and creative ways to use our abilities to serve. From these experiences, many more, my perception of authority has changed from that of being directed by leaders, whether it be family, my husband, who I thought had the answers to everything, and I think what a huge burden that placed on him. From directing, being directed by leaders, to directing and taking responsibility for my own life, I am a real part of this church. I think God wants me to use my talents, thoughts, and feelings to do more than parrot others. Taking responsibility for my thoughts and behavior, not blaming others for my misery or happiness. I want to be responsible in expressing ideas or opinions in a classroom situation with less concern for my fear of loneliness when I think I've been judged as a dangerous item and only to be tolerated. I love the gospel and look forward to change to consider the individual, as much as the organization. I know this is no simple task as the church grows in numbers and cultures, but I believe the revelation given Joseph Smith concerning authority in the 121st section of the Doctrine and Covenants, where Christ tells us what authority is really all about. One of my best experiences with this kind of authority is participating in the initiatory part of the endowment in the temple. We have a long way to go before we can reach this point from my own experience, but I believe it's possible, and it's what I work and hope for.
You'll note that as we go down the line, we're getting grayer, and I'm not certain whether I'm Whistler's mother or the elder statesman. I've entitled my paper today, Meet Me at the Meeting House. On a gray November day in 1957, I lay on a military cot in the officers' guest quarters at the Camp Zama Army Hospital in Japan. Meet me at the meeting house. On a gray November day in 1957, I lay on a military cot in the officers' guest quarters at the Camp Zama Army Hospital in Japan. My four-year-old in the Army Hospital with a leukemia diagnosis and my five-year-old en route to the home of the American ambassador in Tokyo. As I lay staring at the ceiling in this very strange land, I longed with all my heart for the comfort of the meeting house. Wallace Stegner begins his excellent book, Mormon Country, with a chapter he titles, Meet Me at the Ward House. In Roosevelt, Utah, we never met at the Ward House, or the chapel. We met at the meeting house. It was at the meeting house that my dad played basketball and attended bishopric meeting. My mother quilted and attended mutual presidency meetings. My brothers skated and attended scout meetings. At the meeting house, I danced, gave, and attended play practice. I did not understand very much Mormon doctrine, but I was fully immersed in Mormon culture. I fit the pattern for Mormon women very well until 1947. In fact, I was one of the golden circle of married women, the perfect ones, that Linda Sillitoe describes in her novel, Sideways to the Sun. At age 25, I asked to be released from my mutual counselor position. I divorced my husband of 7 years and badgered David O. McKay for a temple dissolution. I took my young son to the Timpanogos School for his first day of kindergarten and proceeded up the hill to my first class at BYU. I was shunned at the Y and at church by those who knew I was a divorced woman. I attended church occasionally and uncomfortably. My parents understood my decision and encouraged me to complete my education and continue their commitment to me and to the gospel. The bishop and the ward members appeared uncomfortable when I attended meetings. I chose not to participate in the discussions, and I made myself as inconspicuous as possible on the back row. Immediately after the services, the security of Meet Me at the Meeting House was gone. Meeting houses, which had been comforting, secure places, became Plato's cave. In the famous allegory, the idea of a psychic prison is addressed. The allegory pictures an underground cave with its mouth open to the light of a blazing fire. The people in the cave are chained and cannot move. They can only see the cave wall directly in front of them. The fire throws shadows of people and objects on the wall. The people in the cave equate the shadows with reality. They talk about the shadows. They name the shadows. They link outside sounds to the shadows. Truth and reality for the chained prisoners rests in the cave's shadowy walls because they have no knowledge of any other. The meeting house, once my source of great joy, became my psychic prison. To better understand the shadows of the cave, I read widely, became an Uncle Herbie rebel, and asserted the descent which is honorable in my family. Reading gave me mobility to move about within the cave. I began the move into the sunlight when I studied my religion and my culture. Uncle Herb and I never met, but we share a common ancestor and some common traits. His grandfather and my great-great-grandfather, Henry Clegg Sr., who family legend records was the second person baptized in the British Isles, Uncle Herb was unconventional, independent, and a rebel, and so am I. Uncle Herb was walking down Main Street on a sweltering Salt Lake City July day when his feet gave out. They were country feet, not used to pavement and city shoes. He sat down on the curb on the east side of Temple Square, unlaced his shoes, removed his socks, rolled up his pant legs, and stepped into the cooling water. He proceeded on down the street toward his brother Brigham's law office, wriggling his grateful toes in the rushing stream of the Main Street gutter. Uncle Herb walked in the gutter. I walked on people's sensibilities. Neither of us could really care what the neighbors thought. Once out of the cave, Uncle Herb and I traveled extensively, often against personal and parental and ecclesiastical counsel. Uncle Herb made the move from Springville to Heber in 1872, and then on to Center Creek, and finally to the big metropolis of Tabiona. I took my six-month pregnant self and my eight-year-old son to Ponape, a small remote island in the South Pacific in 1951, where my new young husband was the assistant to the administrator. In 1956, I embarked with my three sons to spend the next 5 years with my husband, who had now joined the State Department on the exotic island of Java. In 1964, we were off to Lahore, West Pakistan, for a five-year tour of duty. Dad and the bishop warned me of the perils of each course, reminding me there would not be a meeting house in these distant lands. In fact, there would be no saints at all. Uncle Herb made a promise to Aunt Kisty when he left Center Creek for Tabiona. The 1918 flu felled many a good saint in Tabiona, Aunt Kisty among them. True to his promise, Uncle Herb wrapped her large frame in a pieced quilt, lashed it to a sleigh, and pulled it through the wilderness of waist-deep snow. Wolves accompanied him on this perilous journey, but Uncle Herb was independent and dependable, and he had promised to bury Aunt Kisty in Heber, and he did. I made a promise to my parents to make my home, wherever it might be, a meeting house. As president of a 500-member American Women's Club in Lahore, I used my Relief Society skills to organize a thrift shop to fund scholarships for Pakistani women. 40 impoverished Pakistani girls were benefited the very first year. I used these same skills to organize an agency to assist the men and Christian women of Pakistan to find employment. My meeting house at 94D1 was not quite the meeting house my parents envisioned, but I knew they would approve. In Yogyakarta, Indonesia, I provided a meeting place and gallons of sarsaparilla for university students and young government officials to meet and discuss the problems in their country. These same Indonesians were successful in planning and executing the overthrow of communists in 1965. These activities may not be classified as meeting house endeavors, but I felt that I was living the gospel fully and observing the second great commandment. Mayor Jake Garn, a Republican, Congressman Wayne Owens, a Democrat, and a candidate from the American Independent Party. Apostle Ezra Taft Benson gave an address in a public forum, which appeared to endorse the American Independent candidate. Dad had represented the Republican Party for many years in the state Senate, and his party was important to him. He insisted on fair play in politics. He listened in amazement, then went immediately to the phone and placed calls to several of the general authorities to express his considerable displeasure. He requested an immediate public retraction. Haste was important since the election was just a few days away. the official position of the church in regards to the candidates, came that very day. Dad's sister, Lula Clegg, was the first director of the home study program at BYU. Her classic reply to President Wilkinson's non-payment of tithing query was, "When you pay me what I'm worth, I'll pay my tithing." And I don't know how that missed the book that they wrote on the president. With this background, it was no problem at all for me to vote no in a state conference to the release of a very fine bishop and the sustaining of another bishop. Bishop Anderson was a victim of the numbers game. He was guilty of being unable to activate in a very brief time people who did not want to be activated and some who they eventually found did not even exist. My no vote was a public statement of my dislike for the church's obsession with statistics. My dissent was largely unconscious. True, I reveled in the family stories of Uncle Herb. Somehow they had struck a sympathetic chord in my psychic being. My travels and observations pointed out that there were different ways to understand God and the creation. Surprisingly, all of these things had not registered in my conscious understanding of church practice and doctrine. I had read and traveled widely, been a rebel, exerted dissent, but I remained an unquestioning innocent, just like this black dress. I had not left the cave and emerged into full sunlight. A chance event forced me to examine in a new perspective Plato's cave. Quite by accident, I removed from my husband's desk and read a copy of Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. All my experiences and sympathies of honorable dissent began to fall into place. For the first time, I became aware of the tradition of my religion. The church comprised so much of my life that the reality was shocking. For the first time, I realized that I could never fully participate because I was a woman. This greatly disturbed me. For example, in church courts, I would be judged by the same courts as the young boys in my ward, while my husband would be judged by a much higher court because he is a high priest. Aristotle said to be fully human, one must participate in the affairs of state. As a woman in the Mormon church, I am denied full citizenship. I am not fully human. I am a second-class citizen, and I do not like to ride in the back of the bus. Instead of being upgraded, the position of women in the church has been downgraded. We have paid the price for correlation and uniformity. The erosion began when the Relief Society was stripped of the right to raise and spend its own funds. The joys and sometimes the frustration of the bazaars, the quilting bees, the ward dinners, and the financial accounting by the Relief Society president is gone, and so has the glimmer at the mouth of the cave. In my new assignment as compassionate care person, I see three distressing social areas which are not adequately addressed. These areas are education, economic welfare, and health. I asked myself if new dimensions would arrive if women were invested with authority at the top level of the church. Is the answer to return the women's organizations to their former position, or to give women in the church the priesthood, or to lose many of the best of them? I find it discouraging that no women will be in the councils that will hopefully discuss and decide how to improve the fit, feel, and price of temple garments. That item was suggested to me by my oldest son. Number two, and this is my own, and I have very strong feelings about this. How to prepare for the tithe-paying members of the church an account sheet of tithing collected and dispensed. I tell my husband he pays a great deal of money to go down and sit in church 3 hours on Sunday. He pays a full tithing because he's a high priest. I send my money to the missionaries. I have some funds of my own because I want an account sheet. And I have a real big thing on this. So I want them to prepare an account sheet so that I know what money the church has collected and how they are dispensing it. I don't doubt that they're doing right. I just want to see it. The third question that I have is how to improve the missionary program. An innovative woman might suggest that a missionary spend part of his time in a university setting, attending classes and meeting people to ask the golden question. Mind you, I live in the mission field, and so I know that a lot of missionaries' time is wasted trying to find people to talk to. On a university campus, you can always find people, and they would be getting their education at the same time. The health and education missions might even be restored. And some bold person might even suggest some free agency in the selection of a mission field and how long to serve. I am radical. Four, how to call and release paid and unpaid positions in a more Christian manner. The dismissal of longtime faculty members from the church college might never have occurred if a woman had made the decision. And have you ever been in a church position and been released so abruptly? I know of several people that have been released abruptly from teaching the adult Sunday school class, the gospel doctrine class. And I know a girl that for 1 year has suffered greatly because of the way in which they released her from that position. And there should be a more humane way to do it. How to train leaders to love the members but allow them the free agency to conduct their lives. How to stop the manipulating and molding of the members to conform to the present regime. In Anchorage, we have what we call the BBB Brigade. About 10, 11, 12 years ago, we had a new state president. And on the day of state conference, everyone came in, all of the men that were involved in bishoprics and so forth, came to state conference in a navy blue suit with a briefcase. Those men had never worn navy. Most of them wore sweaters and whatever they had. That was the state president insisting that these people conform. And it was really disheartening for me. He's left, and his navy blue suits and his briefcases are gone, and people in Anchorage still feel they can wear a sweater to be a bishop. How to address the real needs of active church members and forget every member a missionary. Now, that's pretty strong, but I believe that. How to train leaders to answer in a more realistic manner the question, why bad things happen to good people. I have a great deal of difficulty with attending a Sunday school class where they are discussing, if you pay your tithing, you will be financially secure. If you do the word of wisdom, if you do all these things, your life will be okay. You find out that's not true, and it's a terribly disheartening thing. And somehow or other, we need to be taught that bad things do happen to good people. How to use more creativity in single Mormon programs. Single Mormons have more time than married Mormons. They certainly could be bishops, stake presidents, presence counselors, bishops counselors, and I think that there should be more creativity in using them to the fullest extent possible. Now, one I have here is how to Christianize the East Bench. You know, the whole height. I'm going to take a few minutes to tell you this because it's important to me on this Christianizing. I came down to Salt Lake City in 1983 to visit my sons and discovered that they were ill. I resigned my job at the University of Alaska in library and stayed here to care for them. I was here on and off, mostly on, for almost 4 years. During this period of time, I called bishops, I called high priest leaders, I called different people to give me some assistance. I never received any. I never even got one batch of chocolate chip cookies from the Relief Society president. When I called the high priest counselor, he came and invited me to a picnic. And I thought I had all the ants I could endure. I felt like at that time that perhaps I should go to church and maybe that would help the situation. So I got up in myself dressed in what clothes I had available and went down to Sunday school. And I walked in the Relief Society room and I felt extremely uncomfortable. And that day they were discussing women who work, mothers who work. And I was a mother and I worked. I'd worked for a long time. And I gave the wrong answers. And that didn't put me, you know, on very good stead with the people that were there. And I went again. I tried one more time and I went again. And when I got in there, I said, there is something wrong with me. And I looked at myself and I didn't look like the rest of the ladies there. I did my own hair. I did not have a navy blue suit. I didn't have a white blouse. And I didn't have any navy blue shoes. So I discovered that really that was the problem. I was not appropriately dressed for an East Bench ward. So I'm hoping that somehow the church will do something about Christianizing the East Bench, because that's where many of our leaders come from. I have one last note here, how to use more effectively the church resources. I think we should all be able to attend Brigham Young University, if you're a tithe payer, free, to take classes in finance, to take classes in health, because those are two things that we all need. And if you pay tithing, you are helping to keep the universities going. They should be able to give us instruction. You can put 1,000 people in a classroom, and we could all have instructions on how to better manage our finance and how to keep our health in better condition. Also, I think that the church might have some form of health insurance that would be available to all members. They've had life insurance, but many of our members do not have health insurance and cannot get it. Final page. I am no longer the naive innocent. I have seen too much war, too much social dislocation, too much hunger, too much suffering, to accept without questioning the pronouncements from the ecclesiastical pulpit. I do not feel as close to the church as I used to, because I am no longer willing to accept pronouncements by sometimes pompous authorities who will not be questioned. I want to continue to grow old as a peaceful, caring individual. I realize it will not be easy, since I have completely abandoned the cave. I understand now that the meeting house exists, but as a much larger, more splendid, grander edifice. It is a cosmopolitan tabernacle, and in it I find new ways to wrestle with good and evil, the central issues of life. I realize that the wrestling never ends and that I must participate and determine the outcome by myself. I want to do this on my own terms. I am hoping to truly discover my sovereign self.
For women, for lives, for experiences with the church, and now we'd like to hear from you. If you have questions for the panelists, for the different panelists, we invite those at this time, but we also invite your responses. What has been your experience with the church? As you look over the long haul, what kind of closeness and distance have you experienced, and what has made the difference? I'm not quite sure how to work the logistics. I know this is being recorded, and we want everyone to be able to hear. The room is very crowded, and this tangle up here precludes us passing the microphone around like testimony meeting. So I think, in spite of the inconvenience, I will ask you to come to the podium if you want to make a statement. If you have a question, please stand where you are and address it to the person that you want to, that you would like to have answer it, and we'll ask that person to repeat the question for the benefit of all. Who would like to speak first? Please.
Well, I can say that I certainly identify with Marie Jones when she got her divorce. I got mine in 1968, and even then, I was a tainted woman in the community that I lived in. And I've been out in the world a little bit since then, and I have found that I was much more accepted there than I was in the so-called Zion West. So I can identify with a lot of things that she has said, and I find that this symposium has been very helpful to me in many ways.
My wife and I were discussing the other day about ways that Mormon women could become more involved with issues, and it seems that because we still have a lot of social stigma that carries over about women participating in work, competing with men in the marketplace, etc., it seems like one of the greatest ways that women could gain entry into society on a more public level and contribute to society is through social issues. It seems like women who are afraid or can't get into society through professional jobs could enter in through public involvement, League of Women Voters, and I was wondering if the Relief Society, and I'm not familiar with this, obviously, because I'm not in Relief Society lessons, but is the Relief Society promoting and emphasizing how women can get involved with these kind of things and still not step on authorities' toes in terms of neglecting their household duties and yet still find ways to get involved with issues?
Do you want to answer? You have something to say on that.
I have a lot of things.
Well, first of all, women have always been involved in social issues. Women have been the backbone of. It used to. I think it has a history of being of involvement, but increasingly, it's become more and more like because it's on Sunday now. It's more Sunday school lessons and that sort of thing. It's also predominantly male voices, too. I mean, some people say, isn't it finally it's a haven of for women's voices? But no, all of our lessons are talks by men for the most part. So male voices predominate even in our own supposed thing. Unfortunately, it seems in order to affect the change, women have. I think it was I could go on and on. I probably shouldn't, but the whole early feminism was very optimistic about changing culture, radically changing culture. It wasn't. They didn't want women to become part of the male power structure. They wanted to transform that structure. They were anti-hierarchy. They were anti that. Somehow they wanted to humanize society, and I still have that vision. But what's happened is that, for the most part, in order to enter that male power structure, women have had to become men or had to adopt the male structure and become part of that. They've become part of it. There are some hopeful signs, I think, in terms of transformation, but I think what we've realized is it's going to take a lot longer. I'm talking in terms of the broader society. And that is, for example, my husband, who's an attorney, and I will go to, dinner parties and that sort of thing, and you'll often hear the men talking about childbirth and children, those experiences. I mean, that's something that I think is very different from what you might have heard 10 years ago. So things are happening. People are having to, dual career families are having to deal with the issues of child care and that sort of thing. But it's still a difficult problem. Is that?
Repeat the question, please, Lori.
Repeat the question. Well, the question, the question is in regard to, do you think that Christ somehow set up the patriarchal order as it is now, or revealed the patriarchal order to Joseph Smith and set it up for some reason?
Right now.
In other words, there may be some reason why it's structured this way, and even though it, is the implication there that it won't be later?
Is there
some reason for it? I mean, it's easy for me to answer it. Actually, no, I don't believe it's a
reason. When I go to the temple, we're talking, is it really from our Heavenly Father?
Well, part of the problem even with the temple ceremony is we don't really know what Joseph Smith instituted. It was never, the temple ceremony itself was never officially written down until, I believe, 1877.
Before the St. George
Temple was opened.
But what do you believe?
What do I believe? Well, personally, I don't go to the temple anymore. Because I think there are a variety of reasons. I mean, my first feeling was when I first went was that it needed a good editor, and that it was I saw it as being, and I say that in all seriousness, it was jarring for me that it seemed to be a Masonic symbols that were used, a Masonic form that had a Mormon script slapped onto it. It was jarring for me. The really coherent ritual for me was the washings and anointings. I mean, ritually coherent ritual. But even that is a problem for me because it reinforces what I outlined as this hierarchy: God, man, woman. Men are washed in anointing to become gods, kings, priests unto God. Women are washed and anointed to become goddesses, queens, priestesses unto their husbands. And I reject that hierarchy.
I will say this is so unusual to have an audience to hear these things. My feeling is we don't begin to even comprehend what the priesthood is. And so I feel, and this could be totally off base, but I feel that the way that I can deal with the endowment and the order of things is that if a man is living as it talks about, if they are holding the priesthood, we would have no question, no wonder, no concern about following him, because then we're partners. And I think that's what it's talking about in there. I think it is talking about becoming people that are equal. And when I go to the temple, I know that I am being spoken to as myself. I mean, I am taking covenants myself. Now, there's one part that, of course, it is different. But I've come to realize that the only person that can save me is myself, and that I must be accountable for myself, and that whatever the others are doing, if they use unrighteous dominion, that is what they're going to be accountable for. And but for myself, I believe in it, and I believe that we just haven't even begun to experience what it instructs Joseph Smith in. And I think that once we deal with that, you know, it seems to me we have this debate going on, and I say, well, wait a minute, you know, the way it's described here, I mean, these are all the qualities every human being is supposed to have, and so once we focus on that, and not then we would be treated fairly. We wouldn't be ostracized because, you know, we've done one thing or another. We would be treated as, you know, in a Christian-like spirit. Might be naive, but...
I mentioned that I go to the temple regularly but not frequently, and I go regularly because I have great hope that the temple will feed me spiritually and nourish my spirituality, and I go infrequently because the experience is usually very painful. And the last time I went, what I noticed was that the first person who looks at Eve in the eye and speaks to her is Satan. Her presence is not acknowledged by her husband or her creator directly up to that point. That was a little bit hard for me. And the time before that, I noticed that the one thing that women have left in the church is birth. And in the temple, that is taken away from them. And God gives birth to Adam, basically. So that was a little hard for me. But as I said, I keep going because I have hope. Now, if others of you have other experiences, I would invite you to share them, especially positive experiences. We don't want to say that this needs to be a forum only for painful or difficult experiences, and it needn't only be temple-related either. But we really do welcome those at this time.
This is an interesting thing for me. It's kind of a culture shock in a way. I take it many here have pioneer heritage and are struggling with the culture of Mormonism. The culture of Mormonism being a convert is a new thing to me. I think when you have difficulties with church leaders, and this is my personal feeling, and something I've worked on, are difficulties in the temple. As a convert, you come down to the fundamental point. Is this God's church? Is Jesus the Christ? You have to understand that none of us know what's really going on. We don't remember. Did we really exist before we came here? The fundamental factor is God really the Father of our spirit, and who are we? And when I have questions, like I'm single, I'm going to the temple, which is marriage-oriented, it's not always necessarily comfortable, but if this is God's church, and he has a priesthood, and these things have been set forth, now they may not be perfect, because this is not a perfect world, but if God is trying to teach us and help us to go, grow, and to learn, then there are certain fundamental steps that we need to go through. But it still comes down to the point, is this truly the Church of Christ. And I'm grateful to have been given an understanding, not by a man, not by a woman, but by God, by the Spirit. I do not understand all things, but as a convert of the Church, I do know that this is His Church. I'm stupid. I have emotions I wrestle with. My life is not perfect. Paying tithing definitely does not make me wealthy. I'm a teacher and an educator in Utah, which pays the poorest salary in the nation. But I do know that I'm growing. I'm the only member of my family, so I have made a cultural choice. I have totally revamped my life. I have not adopted to become a BY Mormon Utah. I'm an individual. I'm unique. And I think when I come down with fundamental issues of someone who possibly hurts me, a disappointment, a criticism, something that I don't necessarily is dealt with kindly in the church hierarchy, the church structure, at least I can smile and say, he's just as stupid as I am. He might be a general authority, but he's got problems too. But the one thing I do know is that this is God's church. Thank you.
I want to make a few comments about that. Number one, I tried to indicate that in my remarks, and that is that ours is not the only patriarchal culture. I mean, I tried to bring in other outside of Mormon sources to indicate that we, and I tried to indicate that one of the things that happens in patriarchal cultures is that women, all cultures, not just Mormonism, is that women learn to devalue and distrust their own experience. And that's why I emphasize that. And I'm respectful of your experience. On a positive note, it seems to me that what a number of women are doing who have questions about our theology and that sort of thing in the church is trying to look at its roots and find out and find other directions within the context of Mormonism. That's why I think you have, I mean, there are some doctrines, as I mentioned before, that I find compelling. One of them is that's been a real problem for women in other religious cultures that isn't for us is the whole idea of dualism. Mormonism doesn't have a sense that we believe that matter is that spirit is just refined matter. Women have always been, in other cultures, they make a strong break between that which is matter and that which is spiritual. And women have always been associated with matter. Childbirth, menstruation, and that sort of thing has always been tied her very much to the earth. And women has therefore been associated with that which is corruptible. And Mormonism doesn't have that, which is a very freeing thing for feminist theology in terms of Mormonism. We have a concept of a mother in heaven, which is a radical notion. And many people are trying to explore that possibility in Mormonism. You know, what relation does she have to God the Father? Is that a partnership, or are we forever condemned, as I don't believe, and I cannot believe, to this hierarchy? And so in criticizing this structure, I think there's a as I said, I'm very tied to Mormonism. It's my tradition. There is a sense of exploring the possibilities of the doctrine, but the bottom line is, I suppose, as I quoted from Ruther, is that when those symbols become dead to you, when those symbols no longer adequately describe your experience, then something has to be done with those symbols. They have to be re-explored and reinterpreted, and sometimes rejected.
And it's lessons. It's a Sunday school class. It's not a women's organization.
Does anyone have something to share about Relief Society, making a Relief Society work for women?
I have a comment, but it's all facetious.
Charlotte has a facetious comment.
Well, I think if we had the men come to Relief Society often enough and see how dead it is, and I know priesthood meetings aren't supposed to be all that great, but they get in there and they're battling back and forth and they're giving all these opinions. At least this is what... Well, my husband... Anyway, my husband's... and my husband's Corin, but you know, if they saw it, they'd say, "Hey, let them have it back." It was a lot better before. I think there is a real communication gap. I don't think the men have any idea how wretched it is for a lot of women. To
Please.
This is slightly off the subject, but some years ago I decided to be taken seriously as a human being, not as a woman. And so I stopped wearing high-heeled shoes, pantyhose, open-toed shoes, and shirts and blouses that button in the back. Look around the room and say to yourselves, are we not taken seriously because we are no better than the Chinese with the shoes that we put our feet into? But the other thing I was going to remark is, we know that every woman works, every mother works. The process of becoming a mother begins with something called labor. And I might just add a plea to whenever you hear someone talking about a working woman or a working mother, just say, always, we always have.
And then who was the person over here? Okay, one, two.
This has been great. I want to know that I'm the Mormon Roseanne Barr. And Levina, it just kills me that things that Levina and I have been saying our whole life, she's making millions of dollars on our routines. She's getting rich. I knew all that stuff. I lived all that stuff. So what else is new? Anyway. But I was thinking about the priesthood, and I think it would be great to have the priesthood. But then I think if you really think about the practical realities, and this is what was just alluded to, and that sparked me up even more, you'd have to sit every Sunday through those boring priesthood meetings. And if you've ever read the priesthood manual, have you seen the difference? My husband and I comment all the time between the difference of between the priesthood manual and the Relief Society manual. But the Relief Society manual has gotten worse. You think, well, we got to get women writers into the priesthood manual and make it a little more humanistic, a little more interesting, a little less boring, and instead we seem to have the males more encroaching into our Relief Society lessons. Like, do you think a woman was the one that suppressed compassionate service on your thing about the Relief Society, getting the Relief Society, being back to Relief Society? What happened to compassionate service? What happened to cultural refinement? Years ago in Boston, they said, well, they're putting it up for a vote. What should we get rid of? Of all the lessons, we got to get rid of one. And I was the only one that said gospel doctrine. We've got that. So what if they dug up, they put two in there? You think a woman did that? I don't think so. So I think we have to really think of the practical realities of things and decide if we want to have, is this going to be a blessing or, dare I say, a burden to us?
Levina?
Sometimes.
I want to say one thing. He asked, he said, how can women become involved in things without stepping on the toes of authorities? And I'd like you to know that I don't care if I step on the toes of authorities.
I have a lot to say, but I'm not going to say any of it, except I do want to respond to the woman in the back. I'm currently a Relief Society teacher, and I have for years gone back and forth from being actively teaching and following the rules, feeling uncomfortable, and then not attending. And I finally decided that what we need is for everybody in this room to attend Relief Society and open up and express your feelings. And that is the only way we're going to solve this problem, because by attending and feeling bad that we don't fit the model and thinking something's wrong with us because we don't fit this model, we don't grow, and they don't grow, and no one listens to each other. So the thing to do is to go ahead and attend, participate, and let your feelings come out. And who cares if you're asked not to? Do it anyway.
You had a comment.
I would say the same thing applies to priesthood meetings, and by doing that, we take the pressure off those of us who do speak up anyway.
Yes. Oh, can I just mention something on that?
I do speak up all the time, as I said, quite readily. And what's very interesting is that occasionally a woman will come to me from the ward and say, I'm really glad that you say that. And what's particularly, getting back to something sort of positive, there's a real grassroots feeling about Mother in Heaven, I think. And I've had several women come to me. Unfortunately, God doesn't talk to me. Mother in Heaven doesn't talk to me either. But apparently she's been talking to some people in my ward. Because I have people come up to me and say, one woman who's a pillar in the ward, and says, she said, Lori, I want to talk to you about Mother in Heaven. She said, I have blessed women in this ward, and I've laid my hands on their heads, and I've given them blessings, and I've told them that I felt impressed to tell them that their Mother in Heaven wants them to know, and such and such. Another woman came up to me and said, I've been praying about women's issues. It's been a real problem for me. I didn't really get any answers, but I did feel the presence of Mother in Heaven, and I felt her comforting there. Her sense was that she's always had to relate to a male God, and she needed a female. She needed a relationship with a female divinity, and she felt, she claims, the spirit of our Mother in Heaven with her. Even though she really got no answers to her question. But when I say to them, well, why don't you say this in Relief Society, they'll say, I don't want to lose my credibility. So they refuse to talk. But it's happening.
I have one short comment, and that is that I think Relief Society really depends on the individual ward, the individual stake, the individual country, the individual person who is there. And I have really been on highs and lows about Relief Society and about the church in general, and it depends sort of on where I am and what's going on at the time. I went from being a 19-year-old missionary in Japan after World War II, 19 years old because I was already living in Japan, when I was called, when we had no MTC, no modern scriptures. Even the Japanese people didn't understand the Book of Mormon we had then, that was clear from the Heber J. Grant days. We had no gospel plan to follow, so we wrote our own. We were told to go out and see what works. And when we told people that Joseph Smith saw God, they said, so what? We see him every day. He's in the mountains, in the trees, in the rocks. And we had to start with the very basics, the nature of God. Who is Jesus Christ? Most of the people had never heard the name before. And build our own things. We became very resourceful at a very early age. I live in a very sophisticated ward and stake right now in Silicon Valley in California with highly educated people. I've been teaching Relief Society for 20 years and started with, feeling really high about Relief Society when I was teaching the Out of the Best Books series, which was the real highlight of Relief Society teaching. Nevertheless, I have learned to be patient and tolerant, because I also now, I've been working in Mexico for the last 6 or 7 years, and I work in a village in a town where when we first started working there, I go about every other month. There were two missionaries on the side of the mountain with chickens running in and out the door and 4 or 5 investigators. We now have in this town in Mexico 5 branches. These people in Relief Society, we first have to find someone who can read the manual, who can read, to be the teacher, to teach the other people. And I have become so much less critical about the manuals. I want for my people in my ward, in my stake, I bring all kinds of enrichment material. I put the title of the lesson on the board. From then on, it has nothing to do with what's in the manual. At first, I was criticized by a couple of people. This has been many, many years' endeavor. But now I can bring in the enrichment books that I use, 10 copies of each, and put them on the table, and they will be sold, and people will be taking them out the door with them every week when they go. And a month later, the Relief Society president will give a book report on one of those books. And our women are so great. I can't tell you what stimulating conversations we have in our Relief Society lessons in California. I don't expect to see that in Mexico. I am just so thankful that there is something written down on paper as opposed to how we had it in Japan, that we can give to someone who can read so that they can begin to understand the basic tenets of the gospel, faith, repentance, baptism, that we're all tired of hearing about over and over and over again, but they have never heard before. And the same manual goes to the whole world. So let's be patient and tolerant and bring in our enrichment materials for our own people. Thank you.
Thank you for being here, and thank you for sharing.